This is the Round Table Podcast, Episode 3.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Humphrey.
And I'm Dave Robison.
And you're listening to the Round Table Podcast.
Each week on the Round Table Podcast, we invite writers to come onto the show and present their story ideas to Brian and myself and our esteemed guest host.
And then we dig into it, talking about what works and what doesn't, and kick around some ideas and try to fine-tune it into a solid, writable story.
Seeking always what we seek, literary gold.
Dun, dun, dun.
And, dun, dun, dun. And Brian, before we get into this, I just want to say one thing. I'm going to add a new segment to the show called Dave's New Inventions. This is Dave's wish list of inventions that I want. And right now, I want a side-mounted gun on my car.
No doubt, right?
But that shoots non-destructive stickers at other cars. And the stickers read, "Use your damn turn signal."
See, I always wanted, like, you know how cops have their light bars now, a lot of them inside the car across the top of the windshield? I wanted a marquee right there. You know, so that I could, with a keyboard, and then I could type in a message, you know, "Get out of my way," or "I'm sorry for what I just did."
And it's reversed so that in the rearview mirror they can read it.
Yeah, oops, didn't mean to cut you off.
Brilliant. Or, "You should be neutered right now so you don't breed." Yes.
Absolutely.
I think we can make a lot of money on that. Okay, enough.
I just want to add that one of my best friend's husband always yells at people as he's driving, "Choose to live."
which is a perfect segue for our esteemed guest host this week.
Ladies and gentlemen,
we are pleased to have on the Skype line with us this evening, Gail Carriger. Gail, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of the Roundtable Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
Absolutely. Is your tea properly positioned in front of you?
It is. In fact, I was just about to take a sip when you asked me a question.
Oops. Well, No,
please don't crucify me, but I always get it wrong. Is it milk that you put in tea?
Oh, yes.
Okay, good, good. Because, you know, it's always a debate between milk and cream, and I always get yelled at. So.
Oh, no, it's milk. There was a brief spate where people actually put cream in, but not anymore. It's always milk now, and I actually don't like the taste of cream in tea, so.
See, and already the volume of information, the gold that's being mined, is going to save men embarrassment at the tea parties.
It's from so now. Important to know.
It's a public service that we're offering here. Gail, it's my understanding that you are preparing for a trip to London. Is that correct?
Yeah, I am. This is the writer brain. I'm also in the middle of a project at the moment. So, and I have a book launch coming up. So they're sending me on tour for that. Just a short tour through a bunch of cities in the United States, and then after that is Europe. So I can only keep one trip in my head at any one time. But I'm trying to organize the European trip right now, and it's like a United Nations because we're trying to get each publisher to fly me from one place to another. but currently it's looking like London for about 5 days, and then Sweden, and then either I'm going to Spain or to Hungary for the last weekend, and then home again. So that's the current idea.
Are these all book stops and signings along the way, or is this is this research and pleasure?
Unfortunately, no. I would like to get away to do some research when I'm in London, and if I have the time, I will. I need to get out to Dartmoor and go south because that's the location for the current book. But probably it'll mostly just be work. I might sneak away while I'm in London to visit my family. My mom's family is all in England. But apart from that, it's just book signings. And I'm fortunate because of the type of books that I write, they organize high teas for me.
Oh, I'm sure that's pure torment for you. You poor girl. So what are the projects that are on Gail Carriger's desk right now?
I'm working on the second in a four-book YA series that I'm writing for Little Brown. So, and everything I'm writing currently is all still set in the Parasol Protectorate universe. So right now I'm ushering the last book into publication. It comes out at the end of the month. So I'm doing all stuff related to that, and that's timeless. So that's the fifth book in the series. And then I am writing the second book in the YA series, which is set 20 years earlier in time. It's a little bit more steampunk heavy and a little bit less supernatural, but there's still a little supernatural element, and it deals with a finishing school, a ladies' seminary that is actually the cover for a espionage training academy where they train young ladies to finish everything and anyone.
Oh, that's chilling. Is there a reason why you backed off on the supernatural creatures in this YA series?
Well, I kind of wrote myself into a hole. The finishing school takes place in this sort of massive dirigible. It's like three dirigibles crammed together that sort of floats aimlessly above Dartmoor. And werewolves can't float according to the laws of my universe, and vampires are tethered to a place, groundside, so they really can't float either. So I just can't have them very
much. Hoisted on your own petard.
They're there dabbling with politics and everything, but currently my main character hasn't really had to have much to do with them. She will. They're going to visit London, so she's going to encounter them eventually. But and I kind of wanted to explore the side of my Victorian London and how kind of the middle class or lower classes were dealing with this infiltration of supernatural into the upper echelon. So it's partly to do with that. And it's partly to do with my own obsession as an archaeologist. I love technological innovations is what I was working my PhD on. And so I'm particularly interested in the abandonment of technology. So I'm dealing this, the arc for this series is dealing with a kind of steampunk technology that actually doesn't exist in my current series. And so what I'm exploring is what would cause a culture to wide scale abandon a technology. So that's kind of one of the things I'm also dealing with.
That's intriguing.
Yes, it's fun.
This isn't the Parasol Protectorate Abroad series.
No,
that's different.
My docket. Yeah, I have a lot. This is the finishing school series. And okay. The Parasol Protectorate Abroad is in the future, about 20 years. And it's going to deal with the British Empire and the crumbling of the British Empire. And so, what this infiltration of vampire and werewolves looks like and how they've evolved and developed in different parts of the world. And so that one's going to be really exciting too. And of course, that's the one I want to be writing because I'm not writing it. So.
Uh-oh. And book 5 of the Parasol Protectorate is coming out soon?
Yep, and the manga at the same time. So,
oh my God.
Yeah, there's a lot going on right now.
Gail Kerger is a busy lady.
Yep.
Excellent.
You could be just sitting at your computer all day long.
And reaching out and touching millions of lives from that keyboard. Gail, if you would, email me any links that we can put up in the show notes and in your showcase page so we can push people in that direction.
Certainly.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. Well, why don't we pause briefly for a promotional break? When we get back, we'll invite our guest writer onto the show, and we'll start digging into some story workshopping. Sound good?
Sounds great.
Excellent. All right. Stay tuned. Yes, Brian. Brian's still here.
I'm still here.
He's just listening raptly.
I'm fascinated. So,
he's intrigued. He's fairy glamour would be like double effective on Master Brian.
Yes. So I'm marinating in all the awesomeness.
And on that note, we'll pause. We'll be right back, folks.
Hey, everybody, I'm Tony.
And I'm Jay. And we'd like to invite you to listen to some of the great short stories available on the New Fiction Writers podcast.
Yeah, that's right. And not only that, we have a fantastic community of writers that contribute their work at newfictionwriters.com for you to read when you're at lunch or whenever you think the boss isn't looking.
So check us out at newfictionwriters.com and join the community of writers and fans of short fiction. And while you're there, subscribe to the podcast. You'll hear some classic shorts from the past,
as well as some of the new stuff from up-and-coming writers.
That's newfictionwriters.com.
Hey, guys, you think we got everything covered?
Yes, I think so. But maybe we should tell them if they know anybody who writes, or if they have a short story they'd like to hear on a podcast, they should contact us at newfictionwriters.com.
I mean, That story isn't doing anybody any good. It's just sitting there in the notebook. I could voice it.
I once knew a man who died before he ever got the chance to show anybody his work. I tell you, if he just had that chance.
That's newfictionwriters.com.
And we're back. Moving on to the next segment of the Roundtable Podcast, let me introduce our guest writer for this episode, Laura Howard. Laura, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Laura, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where you're from, what you're doing, how you started writing.
Alrighty. I currently live in New Hampshire. I'm a native of Massachusetts, but I just made the move up here about 5 months ago. And I'm a stay-at-home mom. I have four kids. And I started writing. I can't really put my finger on that. I guess I'd say that as far as actually writing, because I wanted to write a book about 2 years ago.
Yeah, it's a vague time for all of us when we actually started sitting down and writing stuff. So, well, all right, let's go into your story presentation. Go ahead and let us know. Give us the details of the story you want to discuss.
Okay.
And try and keep it around 5 to 8 minutes or so. And if it starts running too long, we'll give you the ding, and we'll move on from there.
All right.
The mic is yours.
Thank you. My story is a fantasy. It's set in modern America, and also there's some definite. The ending is more in the land of fairy, which you and I know as Tir na n Og. You had asked me about the theme, and I thought long and hard about this, and my theme is going to be balance. For my protagonist, my main protagonist, that means she needs to learn that relationships are give and take, so she has to find her balance there. And for my story world, I looked at balance as being balance for the human realm and the fairy land as well. The human realm being the technology, and the land of the fairies more like the nature. So like a balance 50-50 between those in order for everybody to stay sort of comfortable. So here's my hook. An independent young woman learns that her father is actually a fairy who can restore her mother's sanity if they can break the curse that his sadistic fairy mistress has laid on him.
Nice.
I just wanted to give you a little bit about my main characters. My protagonist, the main protagonist's name is Allison. She's 23 years old, and she's rather introverted. She's a loner by her own choice, but she does have a small circle that she is quite loyal to, you know, just in her family. She starts having dreams and visions of her parents, even though she's never met her father and her mother is schizophrenic. And she starts hearing things and seeing things that really aren't there. So she starts worrying that she's actually developing schizophrenia like her mother. My second protagonist is her father, who shows up. His name is Liam. He was born in Ireland in the 19th century. And he was seduced and lured into the fairy realm by Aoife, who is one of the fairy gentry. He had a brief affair with Allison's mother in Ireland until Aoife found out about this and imprisoned him, and also placed a gesh, which is an enchantment, on him, which made him unable to touch any other living creatures. So I'm going to now introduce my third protagonist. She's Aoife's sister, Nev. And what she does for the story is she offers to help Liam to escape by imprisoning Aoife and vowing to protect and restore Beth, who is the mother of my protagonist, Allison, restore her to her mental health, which I'll get into more later. My antagonist is Bran. That would be Aoife's advisor. He's corrupted. His thinking and actions are corrupted by spending too much time in the human realm. So he's going to be trying to get Aoife back from the human realm and from Nev and Liam, no matter pretty much who gets in his way. He doesn't really care. with that, I can kind of go into my plot points. Does that sound good?
Sure. Sounds great.
Okay. So we start off with Allison sort of living her everyday life. And the thing that really kicks the story into gear is when Allison's father shows up. Now, she's gone for 23 years without any father at all whatsoever. And all of a sudden, he shows up claiming that he wants to help her mother and that he has Aoife's sister who is there to help. He explains to Allison that he's been under an enchantment and been imprisoned by Aoife since before Allison was even born. And he tries to tell her that he never even realized that he had a daughter. Of course, Allison is skeptical of this, but he also explains to Allison that her mother is not actually schizophrenic at all, but she's what is called fairy-touched, which just means that she's gone crazy with longing for him. While all of this is going on, Allison's mother, whose name is Beth, disappears, and Allison and Liam just assume that she's been kidnapped by Aoife's advisor, Bran, as a sort of form of leverage to get Aoife back. When Allison goes to Nev to try and get some help getting her mom back, Nev reminds her that she has sworn an oath to do whatever it takes to get, you know, to keep Beth safe. So she kind of tells Allison to stay put and she'll handle things. And that infuriates Allison. So she, as she's sort of fuming over being told to go home, she overhears a discussion by some of the others in Nev's house that there's a deadly fey vigilante who seeks out rogue fey and punishes them. And she says to herself, this is just the guy I need. So she convinces her father, Liam, that since they're not supposed to be doing anything, they should really be going to find this bad guy, Aiden, to try and get some help fighting off Bran and getting our mom back. So he reluctantly agrees, and they go and they find Aiden. And he, believe it or not, decides that he will help. And they decide that they'll all go back to Nev's home. And they explain the story to Aiden. They give him all the information that they need, that he needs to know, so that they can all work together. And Aiden kind of looks at them like, wait a minute, you don't really understand. I don't think you really understand what's going on. Have you considered that maybe Aoife's advisor is not the one who took Beth, which is Allison's mom's name? Did you ever think that the Fae don't really think like humans? So he kind of reminds them of that. And Allison sort of starts thinking that way and starts, you know, thinking that maybe there's, you know, that her mom's actually okay, and that maybe it was Nev, after all, that sort of took Beth to kind of keep her safe, because she never came out and said, I didn't take Beth. So Allison has a vision of Ethan, who is her on-again, off-again boyfriend, being seduced and tortured by some utterly gorgeous fae, which doesn't really sound like torture, I'm sure. But it's actually a vision that Bran is taunting Allison with. So Allison, Liam, and Aiden travel to the fairy realm to really confirm that Elizabeth is safe, and Allison wants to rescue Ethan because she feels responsible that he's been sort of taken and is now, you know, being toyed with by the Fae. So Liam is reunited with Beth, which is just goes to show you that Beth was, in fact, safe all along. And Allison starts to get some hints that there's some bad blood between Nev and Aiden, and maybe that's why Aiden is, you know, gone into being a sort of fae vigilante. Now, Aiden says, you know, why don't you two catch up, Liam and Beth? You've been away from each other for 23 years or whatever. Aiden volunteers to go with Allison to confront Bran about, you know, letting Ethan go. He has nothing to do with this. And that's where I've pretty much stopped. I'm having trouble wrapping it up. There's so many threads, and I was hoping for some help.
And that's what we're here for. That's absolutely what we're here for. Awesome. Well done. First impressions.
I'm trying to navigate through the maze that I just created on my paper.
Yeah, I did exactly the same thing. So,
yeah, I'll jump in. Oh no, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, you should go first because.
But you're our esteemed guest.
Yeah, but I've not done it before, so.
Okay, all right. I'll just jump in a little bit. So my first impression is there's a whole bunch of stuff, mm-hmm. And you have great names, and you have a really good idea of who everyone is, and the sort of the kernels and the beginnings of their relationships with one another, and I think that you know the pathway through the woods, and like you said, it seems like once you get most of the way along the path, the woods close in, and we don't have a direction. And for me, I think there's it's not convoluted because that sounds bad, but I think that these details, it sounds like you've been thinking about them and poring over these relationships so much that you're kind of losing sight of where you want them to end up. And so my big question is, if Laura is the, or you are Laura, sorry, if Allison is the main protagonist, the majority of the people that I've been hearing about are not Allison. And the people that are doing everything is not Allison. Allison is kind of recruiting everyone to do things. And so I think my question would be, what is her goal? And I know that, you know, on the surface, it's she wants her mother to be well, and then she wants to find her mother, and then she wants to trust her father, but she doesn't trust him. And so there's a lot of those things going on. But what is her through line, or is it really even her story? Because it almost sounds to me like it's more her father's story.
Mm-hmm.
Strangely enough, that's one of the points that I had written down, actually, which is, and I had exactly this thing happen to me with my third book, which was the biggest struggle for me to rewrite was that book, which my editor came down the pipelines to me and she said, your main character is too passive. You have to fix it. And for me, it occasioned about 30,000 word rewrite. And it's sometimes it's a really simple fix. Like you mentioned the one scene where Allison overhears something and that causes her to do so. Have her, instead of overhearing it, go out and actively pursue an eavesdropping situation, like infiltrate, sneak in and listen for something. Mm-hmm. So just if she's your protagonist, all the action has to come from her. And I think sometimes as a writer, we are tempted to give our secondary characters fun things to do, and they have to be given to the heroine. So if literally putting her into motion rather than somebody else is sometimes all that it takes. So that would be one of the things that I was thinking.
Okay.
Yeah, and maybe even you have Aiden, who to me is already my favorite character because I love the rogue who like is vigilante and he's going out and he's, you know, making justice happen. Maybe she even, and this is one of those what ifs that we always give a disclaimer that our ideas may be complete total crap and it's okay to disregard them and do your own thing. But but she could even almost beg to apprentice under him in a way. You know what I mean? Like she wants to do it herself and here's this guy who knows how, as opposed to, here's a guy who knows how and I'm going to give him a mission and have him go do it.
Well, one of the main things that I have going on here is that I have this girl who's always done everything herself and always refused help from other people. And so I definitely know that I have to find a way to make it believable that she's having a hard time accepting their help. So I know it seems like I've given the impression that she is almost like, please, please, you know, I'm a damsel in distress, but she's actually having a hard time asking these people for help, but she just is like, this is all so brand new to her that she's kind of like lost. So she needs a little bit of help, but she also, she needs to learn how to trust other people. So it's definitely going to be, it's interesting.
Well, but she's your heroine.
Yep.
So when you were describing the story to me, the characters that jumped out at me, I mean, you described Allison as your protagonist, so naturally she gets weight in my mind. What really caught in my ear was a father, a daughter who's never known her father, and a father who has lived for hundreds of years, hundreds of years, and never knew he was a daughter. Never knew he had a daughter.
Yes. I don't think you're talking about the same story.
who never? Yes, exactly. Yes, I'm feeling young and pretty. Who never knew he had a daughter? That relationship, that dynamic right there, really caught my attention. And you fleshed out this wonderful the fey intrigues and the fairy court and the dark brooding vigilante and you know, wonderful tropes that you can get a lot of mileage out of. And this is where I invoke the what if. What if this is just a story about Allison? What if this is a story about Allison and her father? I know, like towards the middle end of the book, you've got her father going off with his beloved, but you already established that, you know, they had a fling in Ireland, and you know, yeah, he could pine for her and so on, and you can elevate that, inflame that to true love, or
I enjoy a male perspective on this because I don't really know how a man thinks, so thank you.
Yeah, and you know, if instead of falling in love with Allison's mother, what if that brief taste of love has just made him pine for a meaningful connection, not necessarily with Beth, with Elizabeth, but the discovery that he has a daughter, bam, and now you've got two transformation stories going on. You've got Allison's awakening to this new world and her new position in the world as a daughter, with a father, and the father discovering a new connection to life in a more meaningful way.
Awesome. Yeah. I any ideas on what you think would be a good way to show that?
Well, if it is going to be a story about Allison and Liam.
It's definitely, there's a lot of different threads. Maybe even, do you think that maybe changing it up to multiple points of view would be helpful? Is that where you're going?
That's a possibility, or even just working from Liam and Allison's standpoint. Gail, you have more experience with various POV techniques.
Is it I-personal or third person currently?
Right now it's just third person from Allison's.
Okay.
I'm not sure the technical terms, but
yeah, that's fine. That's closed. Third person closed. You could do multiples. I could see that happening. It might be worth doing multiples just to see if exploring Liam's point of view gets you out of the woods that you're currently in, as it were. Because sometimes even trying to think of the story from somebody else's perspective gives you ideas as to their motivation, and then that character will do something and you're like, oh, that solved my problem. So, yeah, I mean, that might be certainly might be a way to try. It's worth it.
And that's a great suggestion, because another way that you can go with it is to start it off that way, you know, play around with the multiples and then come back to a limited point of view now that you have that wealth of background and that wealth of information. Mm-hmm. Just for my own clarification, because I think I wrote down the wrong thing, Liam, is he a fairy or is he a human that was lured in?
He was once a human, but in my story world, if you spend a certain amount of time in the fairy world, you become one of them.
And that was another question that I had, is are you playing with the fairy realm time shift? Like the idea that as soon as you enter their realm and...
Yeah. So then, like if you're there for 20 years, would go past in the human realm, only like 1 year would go past in their world.
Okay. Okay. So he's young. Her father is like her age.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it's another thing. It was hard to know what details to put in there. Just ask Dave how much I put in there yesterday.
Yeah, Laura and I met yesterday to do sort of a pre-show prep to make sure the story presentation would be terse and concise.
Well, we don't have to know all the details. And for me, it's, and if you just say like, yes, I thought about that and I covered it. So that was one of my questions, which was, so you're obeying kind of the standard Fae rules, Underhill Fae rules that we kind of know and love, like Tamlin style, basically. Is that right?
Kind of, but I'm going further back into mythology so that they're not as Christianized.
Okay. Is there the cold iron thing and all that?
There is iron, yep. There is an aversion to iron. That's another snag.
So fairly conventional Fae mythology with a few story twists.
Yes.
Let me ask you this, Laura. When you were first conceiving this story, was the first thing that you that caught your eye Allison, or was it the Fae?
This actually started off being a human, all human story that was more focused on Allison and her love story.
Okay.
Which I know might sound weird since there's so much other stuff that's grown out of it. I hardly even mentioned her love interest, but it's just kind of grown. I've actually written lots of short stories and backstories to all of them, so they all have like pretty detailed pasts and side stories.
Good.
But yeah, it started off being human, and I've always been, I've always had a special thing for Irish fairies. It's always just been my thing. And so it started off and just kind of took off from there. And
okay.
I figured a way around it.
Okay. I asked in the context of what is it about the Fae realm that makes it a good backdrop for the story you want to tell about Allison?
A good backdrop. Well, I wanted to draw parallels between I guess you could say the balance. There's so much, you know, with the iron that we talked about. Iron is toxic because it doesn't exist in the fairy realm.
Okay.
So that kind of is like a poison to them. And it's kind of like a back and forth thing. So also she needs to learn how to give and take love, affection, support, definitely. So it's kind of like a parallel between those.
And is that something that the Fae, in your mind, in your perception of things, is that something that the Fae embody?
Well, actually, fairies are supposed to be soulless.
Ba-dum-bum.
They're supposed to be cold and unfeeling, and so I guess it sort of started from there, because
so they're serving as a counterpoint to they're the amplification of Allison's fault.
Mm-hmm.
Her tragic flaw is that she's in danger of becoming soulless and cold and distant.
Yes.
Excellent. Good. Hang your hat on that. I mean, if that's the lesson to be learned, then your Fae need to be an example, a metaphor, an archetype, an exemplification of that lesson to be learned. So the Fae become a mirror for Allison, you know, and not directly, not overtly, but with the storyteller's hand, you're saying, Allison, this is a cautionary tale. If you keep going down the road like this, you're going to be like these Fae.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that begs the question, is her father a cold, soulless, heartless bastard too?
No.
Something has pulled him out of that Fae glamour.
He was once human. And a mighty fine lad indeed.
Again, I see the bodice ripper. I see the man with no shirt on, sweating.
I thought we were supposed to be bringing a male's perspective, Dave.
Yeah, well, what is more male than a man without a shirt? Never mind. Go ahead.
Now I'm thinking of werewolves in Twilight. That's
see?
Right.
See? Yes, we know what team you're on. Got it.
I'm on no team. I'm on the Fey team.
Okay.
Anyway,
So the question at hand is Liam a cold, heartless bastard or not?
That's another thing I know that I need to work on is Liam's personality, because he, in the beginning of my story, he comes across as a real douchebag. Pardon my language. But he really is. Like, he's really, he's almost like very smug and awful to Allison. And
classic Fey. Carry on.
Yes. And so he starts off being like, almost like tormenting her and being like, you know, showing up places and kind of like mocking her and stuff like that, even though he's her father. It drives her crazy and she just like loathes him.
At what point does she understand that he is her father?
Well, she knows that he's her father. I mean,
how?
He calls looking for her mother when he first shows up in America.
Uh-huh.
And she puts it together. I mean, she's very smart.
Because I'm seeing a possible, you know, you could do a good 10 chapters based on that discovery and her denial of it. You know what I mean? Because if somebody came to me that was only 7 years older than me and tried to convince me, A, that fairies existed, and B, that, you know, that she was my mother or something like that, it would take a lot of convincing, you know, regardless of how intelligent I am. So that was just kind of where that came from.
Yeah, in my earlier writing, I mean, I've been working on it for a long time, so I guess that's kind of a weak point in my writing, where I just kind of said, you know, Allison heard his...
Figures it out.
What if there was something specific that the mother gave to the father before he disappeared? You know, an artifact?
What if she has a picture, a photograph of him and her mother together, and he looks exactly the same in the photograph as he does when he shows up?
Bam.
Funny how, like, complicated we try to make things.
I mean, that would be a pretty hard and fast proof, not only that it was her father, but also that something peculiar had happened to him and that the fairy lands probably existed.
Sure. Yeah.
Or at least raise the question.
Yeah.
You know, you're 30 years old.
Maybe they got one of those photo booth pictures taken together, right?
Perfect. Perfect. You know, at least enough to raise the question that, okay, this 30-year-old claims to be my dad. Wow, he sure does look for like this picture, blah, blah, blah. That's a great idea, Gail. Yeah.
Thank you. Can I ask another question that's kind of more an Allison motivation question?
Okay.
And this is just like to consider perhaps, but if I would be interested to learn how her affection for her mother has developed, because if you lived with someone who was schizophrenic your whole life and they suddenly disappeared, sometimes that's a little bit more like a relief than like...
That's a good point.
I think it might be important to have her mother's condition exacerbated. So like maybe when she was younger, her mom was a little bit more with it and was more affectionate or something.
Well, I think that the way that it's in my mind so far, the way it's gone is her grandparents have raised her alongside of her mother. So she's always had the guilt.
And
she's always felt like it was her fault that her mother went crazy. So she's more driven by guilt, I guess.
Well, the two aren't mutually exclusive. I mean, really, you could, you know, have her up till the age of 10 years old, which is where those formative maternal bonding years occur, have the mother be lucid and slowly slipping away to the fairy glamour.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, from 10 to 12, she has a dramatic downcline, you know, and maybe that's because Liam came back looking for her, never found her, and, you know, whatever. But something precipitates a decline in her condition, at which point now she's 12 years old, which is old enough to think you're a grown-up, but you're not. But you're old enough to take responsibility and guilt on for the grandparents then having to move in. Plus, then you've got the whole transition, the traumatic transition from mother-daughter alone in the world to suddenly the trapped, you know, with the grandparents and the different rules and blah, blah, blah.
Hmm.
So I don't think the two are mutually exclusive at all. I think Gail's point is valid, that affection, if that's a relevant plot point, needs to be established.
Mm-hmm. Like maybe there's a thin line between love and hate almost. Like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, you can do a real simple, super quick scene of the two of them where her mom is, you know, in a phase and then out of a phase. And when she's out of a phase, when she's lucid, really briefly, she can be super, super sweet, you know, like, you know, picking flowers for her daughter and braiding them in her hair or something, and then go suddenly bats again. So you can get that kind of child-mother relationship that sometimes develops between alcoholic parents and their children where, mm-hmm. you know, the child has this kind of... deep affection because of those moments of lucidity, but also that sort of fear and also parental attitude towards their own parent, which can all be tied up with love and guilt, and it can be drawn in you know, two paragraphs without too many problems.
Yeah. It's funny that you should mention that, because one of the first scenes, and it's not in there right now, but one of the first scenes I ever wrote about mother and daughter was a scene of her mother brushing her hair in front of a mirror and having a little moment where she was, she said, "You look so much like him." And that's all she said, but it was enough that it's something that stuck with her all of her life.
Yeah.
That's
and
beautiful.
Her mom could, like, you know, lean down and just kiss her on the forehead or something like that, you know, like showing a level of affection that then is lost by the daughter. It can be quite key.
Well, and I have a perfect touchstone to prompt those memories. What if, you know, in one of the opening scenes, you know, Allison's sitting there looking at her mother and she's delirious and blathering and, mm-hmm. and seeing butterflies and whatever. And then at the moment Liam transitions from the Fey realm into the mortal world, in that moment, even though he's nowhere near their home right away, have Allison's mother become lucid.
Mm-hmm.
Just for a moment, and have Allison feel that connection and have all those emotions well up, and then the Fey glamour takes her away from her again.
I think that sounds good. That sounds really good.
That will throw Allison way off balance,
mm-hmm.
which then following up with, "Hi, I'm your father," bam, even more off balance,
mm-hmm.
and more weirdness, and then bam, Allison's mother disappears, more weirdness,
yep.
And suddenly Allison has to make a decision. You know, what Gail was saying about the heroine being the motivator of action. You know, you can push somebody so far.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference between a hero and someone who isn't a hero is that when pushed to the breaking point, the hero chooses a course of action rather than withdrawal.
Okay.
So knocking Allison, you know, give us a, you know, a few pages maybe to get to know Allison a little bit, and then start bam bam, knock her off balance,
mm-hmm.
send her spiraling, and then move on from there and get her into that, you know, she's not a hero right away, but at least she's taking action and mm-hmm. making choices.
Yeah. What is it that Vonnegut says? Beat the crap out of your characters so that you can see what they're made of. That's a horrible, horrible paraphrase of his quote, but but that's basically what he's getting at. And just go for it.
Yeah, I like it. I like that.
See, and I'm intrigued. Gail, Brian, and I, Laura, have all glommed onto Liam and Beth and Allison, and the whole Fey aspect
mm-hmm.
has kind of been pushed into the background. And I think, you know, at least in the context of this conversation, I think there's rich material to draw from with that triangle of beings,
mm-hmm.
defining their relationship more articulately and more dramatically. And by that I mean, you know, having Liam have to deal with having a daughter and,
mm-hmm.
and what his plight is and what his arc is in this story.
Mm-hmm.
The Fey becomes anything Fey that you introduce needs to somehow reinforce one of those three elements of the triangle that you're building.
Yeah. And I think, if I may, when he's talking about this, we've had in the last few episodes, one of the things that comes up again and again is we have these grand scale concepts with a lot of interest in the fantasy aspect and all of the fun stuff, and we kind of lose the thread of what is the human story within this. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's kind of what he's pointing out, is that this is, you know, we all see it there, and it is there. And if you can flesh it out, don't get rid of all, you know, the fairy realm and all of that stuff. But once you have the core human story where you can bring in those elements that people can attach themselves to and respond to, then they'll go with you hook and mouth, you know, into the fairy realm with whatever you want to do with that. So
Gail, you know, we're kind of monopolizing the conversation. We certainly didn't mean to do so. What's your opinion of the discussion so far and the points that we're raising?
Well, I kind of agree with the last one in particular. I think the best fantasy books, regardless of what aspect of fantasy, or science fiction for that matter, that you read, are the ones where the world building is used to inspire wonder, but the interpersonal relationships are what inspire kind of depth to your story and the emotional connection with your reader. Mm-hmm. So treading that line is kind of key. My least favorite sort of epic fantasies in general are the ones where they seem to get lost in the world building. And I'm like, let's get back to the story.
Well, and Gail, you're walking that line all the time with the Parasol Protectorate, right?
Yeah. I have to be pretty strict with myself because I have written world Bibles worth of backstory and all that sort of thing. And none of it's ever going to come out into the books, because the point of the books is to tell the story that the book is about. It's not to, like, I know exactly what happened to King Henry to make him accept vampires and werewolves into his world, you know, but that's a couple hundred years before the events in my book. So, and I have, you know, there's no reason for me to talk about it in any of the books. So, you know, there's a lot of world building, and readers will pick up on it. If you've done your world building and it's there and you know what's going on in your universe, then you don't have to write that down on the page. The readers will be comfortable with they'll trust you. They'll be comfortable with the fact that you know what you're talking about so far as the fae are concerned and everything, and that the relevant part to driving the story is going to be the interpersonal relationships between these people.
Huh. So,
to me,
that's excellent.
Anyway, that
makes sense.
The kind of books I love.
Right, and Dave, I think you can back me on this. That, you know, as an analogy to theater, I've always been told as an actor that if you're on stage and you see it in your head, the audience will see it too.
Yes, absolutely.
And so to transfer that into writing, you know, just like Gail said, if you have all of that background in your head, it will translate through your writing without you having to explicitly point out every detail, I think.
That's more like the showing versus telling type of stuff, I suppose.
Yeah.
That's a part of it.
And I wanted to throw one more thing out there, just sort of not even an if, but a for your consideration, which is, during the course of our discussion, we've been sort of zeroing in and focusing on Allison's relationship with her two parents and how that's kind of driving the beginning of the book. And to me, this speaks more as a young adult book than it does as an adult book.
So I was thinking the same thing.
If you might want to consider downing the age of your protagonist and taking out the romantic elements, at least at the beginning of the book, and seeing if, I mean, you might have a stronger tale spoken of with a younger voice, I suppose, mm-hmm. is kind of what I'm going for. Like if she were maybe 16 or 15 or 14 instead of 21, some of her reluctance and some of her journey, as you've kind of described it, towards learning to rely on people, could be even more intense, because teenagers feel things so much more intensely, and they are even more likely to be ultra introverted and ultra isolated. Mm-hmm. And so, and also, if you have a younger protagonist with this fae, using the fae as your foils for her, it emphasizes how childlike these immortal people can be.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have a sort of bounce back between Allison learning and growing and kind of becoming an adult and learning about her parents' flaws and their relationship and all of that, and the fae not learning and growing. And you could have some very interesting kind of comparisons and analogies with that. Huh. But that's, you don't have to do that. It was just an idea so far as the just the relationships as we were talking about just strike me as more YA, but that it doesn't have to be the case.
Well, no, it's relevant because, you know, I think we all kind of felt that same, the issues that we're discussing and the issues that Allison's being confronted with are very consistent with that transition point that YA literature tends to focus on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was actually going to suggest, Laura, that, you know, this boyfriend who's being tormented by these lovely, seductive dark fae later on there, maybe just get rid of him. And if you need a hook to get Allison to go to Bran to the final showdown, mm-hmm. Brian, what were you going to say?
I was going to say make Aiden the interest.
Oh, dude, no.
No?
The dark, swarthy assassin?
He's badass.
Hitman? He is badass. Well, okay. But
the love interest, I kind of assumed from the moment he entered the scene that he was going to be the love interest.
Well, that's what I'm thinking, too. And, you know, I work with teenagers every day, and if you do the YA thing, they will be all over that. Because he's the bad boy, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I can see it. I hate to say it, Laura, but they
I'm
have an excellent point.
So maybe that could even be like a, the truth is that Nev, who is the saving sister of Aoife, that could be a
huge conflict.
Kind of a monkey wrench.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah. Thing.
Very much so.
I think we're approaching literary gold here.
I think we are. Go ahead, Gail.
Oh, I was just saying that the Nev Aoife thing is kind of Glenda the Good Witch versus the Wicked Witch kind of idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I just want to add two things is like in as a future reference. There are a couple of YAs that are kind of in this vein. So, you know, if you're thinking about that, you might want to read them so you don't tread too heavily matters. I think you might have. One of them I was thinking of was The Perilous Guard, which you've probably read, which is...
I have not.
Oh, it's brilliant. The Perilous Guard is Elizabeth Marie Pope, I think her name is. It's a Newbery Award winner, but it's a retelling of the Tamlin story set in Elizabethan England.
I did read a Tamlin story, but not that.
Tamlin as much, but Perilous Guard is a short one. The local library ought to have it or be able to get it. And then the other one, of course, is the Wicked Lovely series. But I think
who wrote that?
Mar, is it Melissa Mar?
Yeah, I read that. I have those. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, but I mean, I think your story is different enough from both of those to carry it without any problems. But
it's definitely it's pretty different. I think I deliberately tried to make it different because I feel like it's been done so many times and it's been done so well, and I love it that I wanted to make mine. That's why I kind of went for the pre-Christianization of like the ancient Celtic beliefs, sure, like the gods and goddesses versus like Seelie and Unseelie courts, which would be more of a Christian type of thing.
The schizophrenic mother and the father relationship thing is also something that like hasn't been done in any of those books too. One of the factors with YA is that almost, or books of this type, is that most of the time the parents are simply removed whole from the scene, right? Or the kid is an orphan or something like that. So I think having the parental relationship element is key as well to making it different.
Mm-hmm. Laura, do you have any questions for us at this point? Anything that you were hoping you would get out of this conversation that we haven't touched on yet?
Well, I don't know if it would apply. The one thing that I was really hoping would be some tips on closing it out. I have a hard time. There are so many plot threads that I need to tie up. I was wondering if there would be any kind of advice on tying things up and coming to a satisfactory ending.
Well, I have a couple. The first one is it can always be a series, so you don't necessarily have to tie everything up. That's the first thought. the second thought is I often find if I write through, so if you're hit up against a wall, but and you don't know where to go, my thing is to throw something at my character. So a new character comes in, or an old character reappears, or something explodes. And then I keep writing. And then by the end of, and then you sort of make your way to the end, and that's the whole goal, right, is to finish the day. And then you will find that you might have to go back and actually take out some of the threads, or even in some cases an entire character, because it's just irrelevant to the conclusion. Mm-hmm. So that's one approach. Another approach is to just sit down with either a mind map or a detailed outline and see exactly where you want it to go without actually having to write it all out. So, I mean, one of those to-go places can be, this is where the character development is, but some of it can be actually physical. Like, I need to have this battle sequence, and then this person has to die, and then they end up at the castle, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is that I was hoping to do a series, and it's like, how do you decide how much wrapping up to do and how much to leave hanging so that it's not like, people are like, oh my God, how could you do that to me, you know?
Oh, make them. You do that to them. Oh, hell yeah.
But then you better write the sequel.
Yes. Well, like, I cliffhanged my second book, and I still get hate mail for it. But
but you're getting mail.
Yeah, I was getting mail.
But my feeling on the matter, in retrospect, don't scattergram too many threads, and it's hard to know how many is too many, and I know that's not really a helpful piece of advice, but I threw a lot up in the air in my second book and found myself with about a billion things that I had to tie up in my fifth book, and I ended up just, like, not being able to do all of them. Like, there are a couple of threads that I know I'm going to get hate mail for that I was just like, I can't. Like, you only have 100,000 words to do it in. So to me, like, one of the tricks is not to put a thread out there tied to a law of the universe that might put you in a bind in a future book. Mm-hmm. In other words, don't tell the reader too much about your world or give yourself too many laws that you have to obey that aren't relevant to this exact story that you're telling this time. Sometimes you're like, but I've developed this whole magical system and people can't cast 5 spells at a time unless they're holding a silver rock. And you're like, but nobody casts 5 spells in this particular book. So you don't need to state that rule. Because there might come a time in the next book where having that silver rock is a real big pain. So,
well, and another example would be, like, for example, I don't know, having vampires tied to a location or having werewolves not be able to float.
Yeah, exactly. And then setting your entire book in 3 dirigibles.
Exactly.
A third option, Laura, is kind of touchy-feely, but it works for some writers. Just sit down and write. Don't worry about the series. Don't worry about the ending. Mm-hmm. Start writing and take a page from Gail's book. Don't edit as you go.
Yeah,
just go forward. Read the story. As you write, you will learn so much about who these people are, what needs to happen to them, what their weaknesses are and their strengths, and your natural instincts as a writer. I mean, you've written this wonderful framework to work with. Just start writing. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about all of those details.
Yeah, and you may find that the characters tell you how to end the book.
Yeah.
You know, they'll take over, and that's always a fun part. Who was it that said, kill your darlings? Because I think that comes up too, doesn't it?
It should have been George R.R. Martin, but it wasn't.
He certainly adheres to that one, but...
Yeah. So you'll find things that's the hardest part for me is I have these wonderful constructions that I think are just brilliant and the words flow like honey, and then I take it to my wife and she just kind of gives me that look and I go, oh God, I got to take it out, don't I? And she goes, yeah, it's lame, like it doesn't work with your story. So yeah, there's going to probably be a lot, because this is so dense, which is fabulous, but there's probably going to be a ton of stuff in here that it's going to be really painful to sacrifice. Yeah. But if it doesn't forward your story, it doesn't belong.
Yeah. I like what Gail said, that she likes to put down the bare bones stuff. I like that approach. It seems like that would make it so much easier to get to the end and then fill all that other junk in later.
Exactly.
I'm not a discovery writer at all, and I'm one of those people who really likes to know where I'm going. So I actually find it it's easier for me as a writer to have some kind of outline. Not everyone is like that, but. But I mean, you could try it and see if it works for you.
Were you always an outliner, Gail?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm such a strict outliner. The first book was written so strict. I actually had scenes that needed to occur on specific page numbers.
Holy crap!
Oh wow! Yes.
But you know what? Look at her line of study.
True. She's a science. You she's know, a science chick.
Yeah.
I'm also obsessed with deadlines. My publishers love me because I get really upset if I can't meet a deadline. So I'll like start sacrificing my entire life in order to try and meet a deadline.
Do you skip tea parties and everything?
Oh yeah, I start punishing myself.
Oh no!
Like I can't watch television. It's
oh my tragic. Goodness!
You know, but
I noticed that your tea party for your final farewell, that looks so cool.
It's going to be fun. I'm really excited about it.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and bring this to a close with something that we really should have led off with, Laura, and this is for your benefit. Everything that was said during the last 45 minutes from Brian and Gail and myself might be complete bullshit.
It probably is.
So, you know, as Gail pointed out, she has evolved her style. Brian has his, I have mine, Nathan, Dan Sawyer, everybody's got their style. You're emerging into discovering yours.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and if you're running into problems like I don't know how this ends, and if you're agonizing over it for more than a few weeks or a month or so, and you're getting nothing, let it go.
Mm-hmm.
Start, take a different tack, start writing, whatever. Find your style. Hopefully some of what you got in this episode will help inform you as you go forward.
Definitely.
Okay, so what do you think you're going to do? You know, we hang up the phone, you get a good night's sleep. What's the first thing you think you're going to do?
Delete us from her email.
After that.
Delete Skype. I think that I am definitely... I think the biggest thing that I think that the whole thing with Liam and the whole daughter-father dynamic was something that was kind of in the back of my mind. I think I'm definitely going to look into that more and try and develop his character a little bit more. And also work on just making sure that, you know, he starts off being... you know, one way and ends up being another way, so that he has some character development as well. An arc, as you might say.
Good. I think that's a good start. I think that's an excellent start. And as we always end all of our episodes with, a solemn vow from you, Laura, that when this story gets written and you end up publishing it in an ebook or an anthology, you must swear to email us and let us know, send us hyperlinks so we can sing your praises and crow.
And I'll say where I got my big ideas from.
That's right. Well, you know, a special thanks. We'll take that. We'll totally take that.
I owe it all.
Oh, well, no. No. All we did was point. You went. That's the hard part. Gail, anything else before we wrap up for Laura?
No, just good luck and have fun and not to be fatalistic, but you never know. It might turn out that this is not the book and it's the next one that's going to be the real easy one to write. So
yep.
Keep your eye on the fact that you know, no author has only one book in them, that there's more coming. So
that's good advice.
Yeah.
That's good advice. Brian, anything else?
I have a request, but I know that it's probably impossible because this is set in modern America. But I really, really, really want you to put a Kelpie in here somewhere. Because that's my favorite fairy, and it's sadistic and it's horrible and it's, you know, it's a very deadly horse. But I want to see it in a book somewhere.
Well, you better read The Scorpio Races by Maggie Stiefvater, because she does Kelpies.
Sweet.
All right. Excellent work, guys. Outstanding.
Thank you.
Outstanding. Gail, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to spend an hour or two with us and help Laura out with her story.
My pleasure. I look forward to hearing the final podcast when it goes out. Let me know.
Absolutely. It'll be probably hitting around mid-March. I will definitely shoot you an email.
All right.
Dear friends, thank you, everyone, for joining us. I hope you got as much out of that as we did. As always, Brian and I always go back to the end of the episodes and play them over again and take notes, because there's a lot of gold in here for everyone.
Absolutely. Yep.
All right. Until next time, this is Dave, Brian, Laura, and Gail from the Roundtable Podcast saying thank you so much, and we'll see you next time. Take care.
Good night.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com. Or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast. Or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.